Penguin Random House Audio presents Razor Girl by Carl Hyacin. Read for you by John Rubinstein. Chapter 1. On the first day of February, sunny but cold as a frog's balls, a man named Lane Kuhlman stepped off a flight at Miami International, rented a mainstream Buick, and headed south to meet a man in Key West. He nearly made it. 27 miles from Kuhlman's destination, an old green Firebird bashed his car from behind. The impact failed to trigger the Buick's airbags, but Kuhlman heard the rear bumper dragging. He steered off the highway and dialed 911. In the mirror, he saw the Firebird, its grill crimped and steaming, pull onto the shoulder. Ahead stood a sign that read, Ramrod Key. Kuhlman went to check on the other driver, a woman in her mid-30s with red hair.
"Super-duper sorry," she said.
"What the hell happened?"
"Just a nick, barely bleeding."
She held her phone in one hand and a disposable razor in the other.
"Are you out of your mind?" said Kuhlman.
The driver's jeans and panties were bunched around her knees. She'd been shaving herself when she smashed Kuhlman's rental car.
"I got a date," she explained.
"You couldn't take care of that at home?"
"No way. My husband would get so pissed."
"Unreal," said Kuhlman.
The woman was wearing a maroon fleece jacket and rhinestone flip-flops. On her pale thigh was the razor mark.
"How about a little privacy?" she said. "I'm not quite done here."
Kuhlman walked back to the Buick and called the man he was supposed to meet in Key West.
"I'll be a few minutes late. You're not going to believe what just happened," he said on the man's voicemail, leaving it at that.
The cops arrived and wrote up the red-haired pube shaver for careless driving. Naturally, she had no collision insurance. That would be Avis's problem, not Lane Kuhlman's. A tow truck hauled away the Firebird, which needed a new front end, including a radiator. The woman approached Kuhlman and asked for a ride.
"Tell your date to come get you," he said.
One of the police officers had pried the damaged bumper from the Buick, and Kuhlman was trying to fit it into the back seat.
"He doesn't have a car,"
said the woman, who'd buttoned her jeans. She was attractive in a loose and scattered way. Kuhlman had a weakness for redheads.
"See, I work for an escort service. We go to where the client's at," she said.
"Yes, I understand the concept."
The woman's fleece was unzipped, and beneath it she wore a black sequined top.
"Her toes must be freezing in those flip-flops," Kuhlman thought.
The temperature was 55 degrees with a biting north wind, Arctic conditions for the Florida Keys.
"My name's Mary," she said, "spelled like Merry Christmas."
"My name's Bob," said Kuhlman, "spelled like Bob."
"Does that mean you'll give me a lift?"
"Why not?"
Kuhlman said. The worst mistake he would ever make. At mile marker 22, Mary told him her last name was Mansfield, like the bombshell actress of the 50s. Kuhlman stopped at a Circle K, where he got a cup of coffee, and Mary bought 3 8-hour energy drinks, chugging the little purple bottles one after the other.
"You running a marathon?" Kuhlman asked.
"I'm all about performance."
At mile marker 17, she told him she didn't really work for an escort service.
"Wild guess. You're a dancer," he said.
"On my own time," she replied. "Not one of those."
"I didn't mean it in a bad way."
"Why didn't you just say stripper? The games you guys play, I swear."
Her eyelashes were a paler shade of red than her hair. Kuhlman said,
"Why would you make up a lie about being an escort?"
Because I needed a ride, Bob. If I said I was an artifacts appraiser, you would have left me standing in the road.
What is it you appraise?
Sunken treasure. Doubloons and cannonballs and so forth. Business is slow right now. I'm an expert on 18th century Spanish maritime.
Do you have a real date, or did you make up that part, too?
Mary laughed.
He's an Air Force pilot, based at Boca Chica. Why else would I be doing my trim at 65 miles per hour?
At mile marker 8, she blurted,
Did I say Air Force? I meant Navy.
She was buzzing like a flagpole in a lightning storm.
His name's Rocky.
What about your husband?
He's Rocky, too.
Stop, said Kuhlman.
Don't be judging me. I go for men with strong names.
The closer they got to Key West, the more southern her accent became. Kuhlman was foolishly intrigued.
What about you? She said. What's your field, Bob? Your expertise?
I'm in the entertainment business. I manage talent.
Your own or somebody else's?
Ever seen the show Bayou Brethren? Kuhlman asked.
Little Rocky watches it all the time.
That's your son, Little Rocky?
No, it's what I call my husband. Don't make me spell out why.
Anyway, I manage Buck. You know, the family patriarch? Buck Nance.
No shit.
Leader of the clan, said Kuhlman.
Yeah, Bob, I know what a fucking patriarch is.
The show was taped in the Florida Panhandle at a swampy location that somewhat resembled a Louisiana bayou. Buck Nance and his brothers were actually from Wisconsin, but the network paid for a Cajun dialogue coach. Mary said,
So what brings you all the way down here?
Buck has a personal appearance.
Where?
Parched pirate.
Doing what?
Just being Buck.
Kuhlman hoped the guitar player had found the bar. Buck Nance had trouble speaking in public unless he was accompanied by a live musician. For his road gigs, the writers at the network had come up with 8 or 9 amusing redneck stories, what you might call a monologue, and afterward Buck would take questions for 10 minutes or so. The questions were printed on index cards distributed in advance to random fuckwits in the crowd. Kuhlman offered to take Mary to the show.
We'll hang backstage, he added, like there was a backstage.
What about my date? She asked.
Bail, Kuhlman said. Tell him the truth. You had car trouble.
But then I shaved down there for no reason.
Not necessarily.
The redhead smiled and shook her head.
For the Zac Brown Band, I'd ditch my Navy boy in a heartbeat, but not for some yahoo from the bayou.
It's only the top-rated cable program in the whole country.
I prefer the nature channels. You know, penguins and cheetahs. Shit like that.
Buck converted his Bentley to an ATV with rifle racks.
Why would a grown man do something so ridiculous?
America worships the guy. You should come hear him tonight.
Another time, said Mary.
At mile marker 5, she made a call on her cell phone. All she said was,
Don't wet yourself, sugar. I'm almost there.
At mile marker 4, after they'd crossed the bridge into Key West, she flipped open the visor mirror and checked her makeup, freshened her lipstick, brushed her hair.
You look terrific, said Kuhlman.
Damn right, Bob.
At mile marker 3, she exclaimed,
Okay, pull in here.
It was a small shopping center with a Sears as the high point. Mary directed Kuhlman where to park. He was surprised when a white Tesla rolled up beside them.
That's your boyfriend?
Kuhlman knew a couple of CAA agents back in L.A. who drove jet black Teslas. The white model looked pretty sweet. Kuhlman himself leased a corpuscle red Mercedes SLK 350 that required no electric outlet.
I thought you said he didn't have wheels.
Mary shrugged.
Must be a loner.
The young man who got out of the Tesla was wearing a leather bomber jacket. If not for the gold earring and oily long hair, he could have been a Navy pilot.
It was nice meeting you, Kuhlman said to the redhead.
Oh, you're coming with.
Me? What for?
The man in the bomber jacket yanked open Kuhlman's door and put a pistol to his neck.
Let's go, dipshit.
Just take my wallet, Kuhlman said, breathless. The Rolex, too. Whatever you want.
You're adorable, Bob, the woman whispered. Now get out of the fucking car.
Bayou Brethren had been conceived as a reality show about moonshiners, but another network snatched that idea first. Next on the concept list was pig farming, the unsavory auditions dragging on for months. Eventually, Buck Nance and his three younger brothers were chosen to star in the program, though they knew nothing about swine husbandry. They got the nod because of their exquisite beards, rough-edged banter, and punctuality. The pilot episode of Bayou Brethren was a major disappointment, the visual appeal of high-def hog shit having been overestimated by a network vice president who was summarily promoted to a more harmless position. The new network vice president in charge of the project felt the brothers needed a more esoteric vocation to distract from their unappealing personalities, a view shared by potential advertisers who'd screened the off-putting pilot. Specialty chicken breeding was chosen as the alternate milieu. Buck and his brothers would raise prize roosters, whose multi-hued hackle feathers would be crafted into beautiful flies for catching game fish such as trout and tarpon. Midway through the first season, Buck got pecked in the eye while chasing one of the birds, which he vanquished indecorously with a babola tennis racket. The show's ratings soared, and the Nances made the cover of People magazine. Currently, Lane Kuhlman's agency was negotiating preposterous new contracts for the clan, and during a short break in taping, it was decided to put Buck on the road in a few soft markets, South Florida being one of the softest due to its diversity. The parched pirate was packed, so Buck was on edge. Kuhlman hadn't arrived yet, which meant no pep talk, no wild stories about the hot babe or babes Lane had banged the night before. Even though there were direct flights to Key West, Lane had insisted on driving down from Miami because he said he wanted to see the islands. Now he was late for the event, something that had never before happened. Buck and Lane had a certain way of getting ready, and Buck faltered if their routine was altered. Plus, the guitar player was nowhere in sight. Some cow-eyed slacker from Pasadena, all he had to do was pick a few notes while Buck told humorous redneck yarns. Buck had lobbied for a banjo player, but Lane said they cost too much, which made no fucking sense to Buck, because a banjo's got fewer strings than a damn guitar. Before the show, Buck waited alone in a small room that had a card table and a couple of folding chairs. He would have preferred to park himself at the bar, except he would have been mobbed by fans. The manager said several male customers had torn off their shirt sleeves in homage. Buck always wore a wife beater on TV. Sometimes he'd stay after a gig and autograph the shirt fragments, but not tonight. No way. The bartender poked his head in the door.
Ready, dude?
Born that way, said Buck Nance, though he was definitely not ready. Where the hell was Lane?
The message he'd left on Buck's phone said something crazy had happened.
Everybody cheered and woo-hooed when Buck ambled onto the small stage. Lane had assured him that the parched pirate drew a good biker crowd, and Buck was relieved to see lots of black leather mixed in with the cruise ship garb. He relaxed a little.
waved, gave a fist pump. Somebody handed him a Jack and Coke, which he gulped. Then somebody handed him another. The first bit started out fine. It was the one about a good old boy who comes home drunk and rolls into bed with what he thinks is his wife, but it turns out to be a bear. Only the man is too trashed to notice, and the two of them, him and the bear, are sleeping spoon-style when the wife walks in. But storytelling wasn't the same for Buck Nance without the accompanying guitar, which set a laid-back mood. He started blanking. Not stage fright exactly, just a few crucial gaps in the memory loop. It had happened two or three times before, but Lane Coolman had always been there, stage right, with a verbal cue to lead Buck back on track. Not tonight. The microphone felt like a barbell in Buck's sweaty hand, and he wrapped up the bear and hairy wife story as best he could. People chuckled, though it sounded to Buck like a communal politeness, and not the genuine guffaws he'd come to expect in working-class sports bars. He wondered if he'd been given some faulty information about the parched pirate, and Key West in general. He couldn't remember the second yarn on his set list. So, in an ill-considered burst of spontaneity, he decided to tell a joke he'd heard from one of his brothers.
"Hey, why can't homos drive faster than 68 miles an hour?"
Buck Nance said.
"'Cause at 69, they blow a rod."
The barroom didn't go silent, but the walls weren't exactly shaking with riotous laughter. Buck wondered whether the joke worked better if you used faggot instead of homo. Next, he told the one about four black guys in an Escalade arriving at the gates of heaven, and this time not a living soul chuckled, not even the Caucasian drunks in sandals. A couple of heavy-set individuals in the back of the room called Buck a racist asshole and began a sharp-elbowed charge toward the stage. Buck was unaccustomed to such naked hostility, and he'd prepared no clever comeback lines like real stand-up comedians do.
"Just chill out, sports fans," was what he said, desperately scanning the crowd for Lane's face. Where the fuck was he?
Soon enough, it was explained to Buck Nance that Key West was a bad location to be making fun of homosexuals and also African-Americans. This bulletin was delivered by a 275-pound biker who happened to be both gay and black and owned a right hand that fit easily around Buck Nance's stringy, hirsute neck. Bouncers pulled the aggrieved patron away before the strangulation was complete, and Buck revived, coughing and beat-faced. Angrily, he began spewing down-home expletives that included the N-word, igniting a melee between a few die-hard fans and the rest of the audience. Buck got walloped by flying fists and Budweiser bottles, and at one point a man costumed as Lady Gaga attempted to rip the beard from his chin. The man was surprisingly strong and wore just enough jasmine perfume to be distracting. With the bar manager's assistance, Buck shook loose and fled through a back door. In no particular direction, he ran through the alleys of old Cayo Hueso, fearing, not irrationally, that he was in mortal danger. Yancey was bummed because Rosa couldn't drive down from Miami for the weekend. She had the night shift in the ER at Baptist. Selfishly, he sometimes wished she still worked at the morgue. The hours were better because no urgent care was required. He finished his glass of rum, grabbed his only sweater, and went outside to stare at the stars. After a few chilly minutes, he wished he'd put on some shoes and long pants. Somebody with a flashlight was walking back and forth in the vacant lot next door. The lot was blooming with weeds and still littered with charred rubble from the arson that had leveled the previous owner's unfinished villa. Yancey hadn't set the fire, though he bore indirect responsibility and no remorse. Afterward, the property had been surrendered in savage divorce litigation to the owner's wife, who'd recently sold it. Yancey stepped down from his backyard deck, gingerly climbed the chain-link fence, and made his way toward the stranger carrying the flashlight. It was a woman, and he startled her. She aimed the bright beam at his eyeballs, saying,
"Hey, just back off!"
"Relax, I live in that house." Yancey reached out and repositioned her flashlight. "What are you looking for?" he asked.
"A ring."
"What kind of ring?"
"None of your business. I must have dropped it this morning."
"When you were here doing what, exactly?" In the darkness, Yancey couldn't see the angles of her face, but her skin looked glossy and her hair was light-colored. She sounded younger than he was.
"I was with our landscape architect," the woman said with a ludicrous air of importance. "And my fiancé."
"So it was your engagement ring you lost. That sucks."
"Hey, do you mind?"
It was an odd place to drop an expensive piece of jewelry. Obviously, the woman hadn't told her future hubby, otherwise he would have been out there helping her search for it. She said,
"If you don't go away right now, I'm calling the cops."
Yancey tipped an imaginary cap. "At your service." In the not-so-distant past, he had been a real detective. Now he was stuck on the roach patrol, scouring local restaurants for threats to public hygiene. "My name's Andrew Yancey," he said.
"Let's see your badge."
"I'm in my boxer shorts, and crushed that you didn't notice. My badge is back at the house. You want some coffee? It's freezing out here."
"What I'd like is for you to leave me alone," the woman said, "unless you're planning to arrest me for something."
"How many carats?"
"What?"
"Your missing ring," Yancey said. "Carats, as in diamonds, not bunny food."
"That's such a rude question."
"My specialty. Is your rock bigger than, say, a pistachio? I've got a cordless spotlight, is the reason I ask. You want some help?"
"No," the woman replied. "I do not."
Yancey walked back to his place, thinking she didn't believe he was a cop or else she would have been more respectful. On the other hand, his nocturnal approach in underwear and bare feet might have made a sketchy first impression. He was annoyed at himself for not asking the woman what she and her fiancé were planning to build next door. Yancey treasured his sunset view on Big Pine Key, and he hoped the new couple would honor the height restrictions in the building code. Nothing less than Yancey's own peace of mind was at stake. He didn't want more trouble on the street now that Rosa was spending more time here. In the kitchen, he put on some Jack Johnson, fired up a joint, and texted Rosa a photo of the two fresh lobster tails he was about to grill. Nearby, he heard a car door slam extremely hard, suggesting that the woman with the flashlight had not located her lost engagement ring and was giving up for the night. There was an angry-sounding yelp of tires as she sped away in what sounded to Yancey like a high-powered European sportster. After dinner, he slipped on some jeans, and to spare his feet from the concrete shards and splintered lumber, a pair of thick-soled Rockports. Then he took the Q-beam from his skiff on the trailer in the driveway and returned to the empty lot. The spotlight had a powerful halogen bulb, 3 million candle power. From 100 feet away, Yancey spotted the glimmer of the diamond in a clump of weeds. It was a very large stone, which likely meant that the woman and her fiancé intended to build a very large house. "Shit," said Yancey. He picked up the ring and shoved it into his pocket. At 11:30, he heard the phone chirping out on the couch where he'd left it. He knew Rosa wasn't calling because she was still at work in the ER. "You sleeping?" asked Tommy Lombardo. "Yes," Yancey lied, "and I've got company." Lombardo was his supervisor, not a bad guy. Mostly, he left Yancey alone. "It's an emergency, Andrew." An emergency on Roach Patrol was code for an active infestation.
Where? Yancey asked.
Clippies.
No way.
Clippies was one of the cleanest joints in Monroe County. Yancey had never found as much as a dead housefly on the premises.
Tommy, what manner of pest are we talking about?
No varmints, no insects.
Screw it, then. I'm going back to bed.
They're waiting for you, Andrew.
Who?
Clippy and his partner. You understand?
Yancey did understand.
Tell me what we're dealing with, Tommy. It's almost midnight, for Christ's sake.
You know this already from your cop days, said Lombardo. There's some fucked up people in the world. Is that front page news? I don't think so.
Chapter 2. The man with the long, oily hair wasn't named Rocky, and he wasn't Mary Mansfield's boyfriend. Zito is what she called him. He and Mary had been hired to kidnap a swindler who'd pissed off a short-fused individual in the borough of Queens, New York. The swindler's name was Martin Trabeau, and he was driving from Miami to Key West in a late-model four-door Buick painted Quicksilver Metallic, a factory job virtually indistinguishable at dusk from Champagne Silver, another standard color in rental fleets.
You hit the wrong fucking car, Zito informed Mary.
Hey, you said Silver Buick, did you not?
Wrong fucking car, wrong fucking guy.
Zito half-heartedly kicked Lane Kuhlman, who lay hog-tied on the floor.
Maybe it's him and he's just carrying fake ID, Mary said, hopefully.
No, this is definitely not Trabeau.
Zito had pawed through Kuhlman's wallet. The photograph on the California driver's license matched Kuhlman's face, which did not match the pictures of Martin Trabeau that had been texted to Zito. Trabeau was sandy-haired, jowly, and had the pursed countenance of a feeding carp. Kuhlman's features were more angular, and he owned standard hominid lips.
You fucked up. End of story, Zito said to Mary.
No, dear, we fucked up.
From Kuhlman,
just let me go and we'll forget all about it.
Hush now, Bob, said Mary.
Kuhlman didn't believe the oily guy with a gun would actually kill him, reflecting an insufficient concern for his own well-being. That he was more worried about Buck Nance bombing at the Parched Pirate underscored Kuhlman's laser focus on his career. Buck and his brothers were the agency's hottest clients, a galactic media phenomenon, but they required round-the-clock supervision. Buck, in particular, could be a runaway train.
There's $2,000 cash in the wallet, Kuhlman said to Mary. Take it all and let me walk. You told me your name was Bob. Don't I deserve better than that?
Here Zito cut in.
He wanted to bang you is all.
Kuhlman didn't bother to deny it.
Don't make this any worse than it already is. You got the wrong man, okay?
Mary said,
then prove it.
Give me back my phone and I will.
Zito said,
he's not Trabeau, so shut up and let me think.
The floor was cold terrazzo. Mary unrolled a yoga mat and sat down beside Kuhlman. There was no furniture in the house. Two bulbs in a recessed ceiling fixture provided the only light. Zito had forced Kuhlman at gunpoint through a back door after parking the Tesla in an alley. Now the gun peeked from a shoulder holster beneath Zito's leather jacket. Mary had offered to help tie up their prisoner, but Zito insisted on doing it himself, saying he didn't trust Mary's knots.
I need to make a call, he grumped.
God, no kidding you do,
she rolled her eyes. As soon as Zito left the room, Kuhlman began lobbying Mary to be the reasonable one, the one wise enough to see that holding him captive would be a disastrous mistake.
"You want to go to jail for the rest of your life?" he said. "Because of that guy? Are you really a talent manager, or is that more bullshit?"
"No, it's the truth. Buck Nance is waiting for me right now at the gig."
"We'll see about that."
Mary took Kuhlman's cell phone out of her handbag where it had been tooting and humming every couple of minutes. This was pure torture for Kuhlman, who, like all agents, hated missing a call.
"What's Mr. Buck Bayou's number?" Mary asked. "Jesus, I don't remember off the top of my head. Speed dial it from my favorites." "Woohoo! Look at this! Mark Wahlberg, Reese Witherspoon, Denzel... Are you kidding me?"
"Scroll to the ends," said Kuhlman. Mary found Buck Nance's name and touched the number. A woman answered. Mary had difficulty hearing her because of a grinding roar on the other end. The woman said she was on the back of a motorcycle cruising Duval Street. Her boyfriend had found the phone on the floor of a bar. Somebody had crunched it with a boot heel, but it still worked. The woman asked Mary to tell the owner of the phone to swing by Blue Heaven later and pick it up.
"Just keep it, honey,"
Mary said, and hung up. Kuhlman was unsettled by the news that Buck Nance had lost his phone. He pleaded with Mary to redial and find out if the woman had attended Buck's show. Mary said,
"What, now I'm your secretary? No, sir."
She zipped the fleece up to her neck.
"It's cold in here, right? My nips are basically icicles."
"I'm guessing you're not really married," Kuhlman said. "There are no Rockies in your life, right? And you know nothing about sunken treasure."
"More than you do, I bet."
"What's your real name?" She laughed.
"Mary Mansfield."
The ropes on Kuhlman's wrists were strung so tight that he'd given up trying to squirm out of them.
"Really? This is what you do for a living? Crash into strangers on the highway?" "There's a trick to it," Mary said, "especially holding a razor."
She had done 14 solo bump jobs, $800 each, never once injuring herself or the target. Her preferred speed at impact was 6 miles per hour faster than the car she was hitting. She'd learned the technique from a guy in South Beach, her boyfriend at the time, an insurance fraudster and confirmed shitweasel. Now Mary worked totally freelance off her reputation. The bikini shave aspect of the scam was her signature, pure genius because the targets were always men. Often she wasn't told who had ordered the crash, but the why never changed. Somebody was dodging a debt. The objective of the abduction was money, not murder. Mary viewed herself as an independent contractor in the collection process. Zito provided the bump vehicles. Mary kept a brick of fake IDs for when the cops arrived to write up the accident. This was the first time she'd taken down the wrong car, and she blamed Zito for fuzzy intel. His text had said, "Southbound silver late model Buick LaCrosse with white male driving early 30s. No tag number, no specificity on the precise shade of silver, and, by the way, who could tell a freaking difference between Quicksilver and Champagne?
Trabeau's here in Key West," Zito announced upon his return.
"So the job's still on? We can set up the crash on a side street. Easy peasy," said Mary.
Zito snorted.
"What makes you think we'd use you again?"
Mary let the insult pass because she needed the money.
"So, meantime, what should we do with Mr. Hot Shit Talent Manager?"
"Dump him in the ocean," was my orders.
"You mean kill him?"
Mary said.
"You're a quick one, babe."
Zito took out his gun. Kuhlman was thunderstruck.
"Don't be a fucking idiot,"
he bleated at Zito. Then, less excitedly, to the red-headed woman.
This would be the all-time, worst-ever, dumbest thing you could ever possibly do. They'll lock you up for life.
He thought the scared straight approach would be more effective than weeping. Zito said,
Lock us up for what, dipshit? Your body won't never be found. 20 miles out at sea in the belly of a goddamn tiger shark is where you'll be at. No victim, no crime scene, no evidence. Arrest us for what, Einstein?
Mary gave Kuhlman's head a commiserative pat.
His mind's made up, Bob. Sorry.
No, wait, please,
said Kuhlman, and without further delay began to beg.
You want money? Because the people I work for will pay big bucks to get me back safe and sound.
Zito seemed mildly interested.
Mary said, Define big bucks.
She dialed another number on Lane's phone, and he heard her say,
Hello, is this Mr. Mark Wahlberg? You're shitting me! Mark freaking Wahlberg?
A shark attack might be less painful, Kuhlman thought despairingly.
Sir, a speed dial compadre of yours is in major trouble,
Mary went on.
Mr. Lane Kuhlman, okay? The talent agent. There's bodily harm in his future unless somebody comes up with, I don't know, $500,000 by noon tomorrow? I see. Well, yes. All righty then. Sorry to trouble you, sir. By the way, you were amazing in Boogie Nights. That last scene at the mirror, fucking awesome!
Kuhlman's chin was on his chest by the time Mary hung up. That was some heavy number, 500,000, to pull out of her ass.
It was really him?
Zito asked.
The Marky Mark?
It was, said Mary.
So what's the story?
First he said, Lane Kuhlman's not my friend.
Figures.
Zito glared at his captive.
He said Mr. Kuhlman is a worthless douchebag. His exact words,
Mary related.
And we'd be lucky to get 5 fucking cents for a ransom.
Zito cackled and put a round into the chamber.
This is from the movie star, right? Unbelievable. A worthless douchebag, he says.
Hold on, just wait, please,
Kuhlman cried.
Scroll up to the A's, and I'll tell you which name to call.
Mary said,
Now we're getting somewhere, sugar.
Clippy was Irv Klipowski. His partner was Neil Gluckman, who happened to be the mayor. That's why Lombardo had summoned Yancey so late at night. Nothing turns you into a responsive civil servant faster than a phone call from the mayor. Hop in your car and go. Neil and Clippy weren't down-home island bubbas, but rather New Yorkers who'd hit a home run on Wall Street and then semi-retired to Key West. At first, they were distrusted because of their sobriety and competence, but in time, the locals accepted them. Clippy was a long-distance runner who had a goatee that he dyed goose white. Neil narrowly won the mayor's race after his opponent got busted in the Marquesas, cramming 2,000 mollies into a scuba tank. The restaurant they owned was only a few blocks from the Hemingway House. Lunch and dinner were offered, brunch on Sundays. The designated cuisine was Heart Healthy, a menu gimmick designed to ward off the cruise ship crowd. Clippy could be a snob at times. He led Yancey to a stainless steel vat in the back of the kitchen. That's quinoa, Andrew. Please don't tell me you've never had it.
I eat it twice a day, sprinkled with kale.
There must have been 25 pounds of the stuff, which to Yancey resembled bullfrog eggs. They call it a supergrain, Clippy said dully. It's got lysine, B2, and manganese, the mortal enemy of free radicals. Not to mention it's a natural laxative.
So is rum.
And totally gluten-free.
I love gluten. I always order extra.
This is in no way funny, Andrew. Yancey pointed at something in the vat. That's your emergency, correct? Clippy nodded somberly.
We were slammed tonight. He must have snuck in the back door when the chef was busy. You need a bag?
I brought my own, thanks. Yancey donned a pair of latex medical gloves. Rosa had smuggled him 2 boxes from the ER.
What kind of monster would do something like this? Clippy said with a world-weary groan. Neil took one look and got ill. I sent him straight home.
Yancey handed a Ziploc baggie to Clippy. Hold this open for me, please.
He used our herb scissors, too. You'll need those for evidence.
Oh, absolutely. The shears were a top-of-the-line German brand. Yancey set them aside, thinking Rosa might need a pair. Then he reached into the vat and began to remove the offending adulterant, damp clumps of wiry hair. The strands were silvery gray, flecked with black, and they smelled of stale booze. Yancey ended up filling 3 baggies. Clippy whispered,
"Please tell me it's from a human."
"That or an alcoholic opossum."
"God, this is so revolting."
Yancey was sympathetic but firm. "You've got to 86 all the quinoa for tomorrow."
"Well, certainly."
"Then spray down your countertops and nuke this tub at like a zillion degrees."
"Done and done," Clippy said. "Neil told me to tell you we definitely want to prosecute. Your lab people can get the DNA from the hair, right?"
Yancey suspected that the Division of Hotels and Restaurants employed no laboratory techs and had 0 budget for genetic testing.
"You can nail him for trespassing, obviously," Clippy was saying, "tampering with food products, malicious, whatever they call it, misbehavior. Throw the book at this perv."
"I'll let you know if we come up with an ID."
"Dust the shears for fingerprints."
"Of course," Yancey said, knowing it wasn't going to happen. Clippy, who apparently watched every CSI show on television, would have been crestfallen to learn that the Roach Patrol held no police authority. Yancey could shut down a restaurant for gross health code violations, but he couldn't throw anybody in jail. Nor was forensic work part of his job description, unless counting mouse turds qualified. "You should probably file a police report," he suggested to Clippy.
"What? And see it all over the news? Neil would never forgive me, Andrew. It would devastate our business."
By the time Yancey drove back to Big Pine, it was 2 in the morning. He placed the bags of Vandal hair in his refrigerator and drifted off to sleep. At some point, Rosa called to tell him about her night in the ER, another rough one. For months, he'd been trying to persuade her to relocate to the Keys, where assault rifle wounds and spousal eviscerations were rare. But Rosa was a city girl.
"I miss your legs," Yancey said.
"Are you behaving?"
"Some moron dumped like a kilo of dirty hair in the kitchen at Clippy's."
"Thanks for the visual," Rosa said.
"He used the steel bowl as a mirror while he gave himself a trim. Hey, you need some herb scissors?"
"Night, Andrew."
He fell asleep while writing his report. He dreamed of tarpon rolling in Pearl Basin until he was awakened by a knock. It was a harsh intrusion, so soon after sunrise. He stalked, cursing, to the front door and flung it open. The woman who'd lost her diamond engagement ring was standing there. Her eyes crawled up and down Yancey, who was nude except for his reading glasses.
"I'll take that cup of coffee now," she said.
It was assumed by locals that Buck Nance had made his way to the airport, hopped a chartered jet, and fled the island. Everybody figured that, like all celebrities, he employed savvy handlers to whisk him away whenever a crisis occurred.
The incident at the Parched Pirate didn't make the morning print edition of the Key West Citizen, but a headline was bannered on the newspaper's website, along with two videos of Buck's brief performance provided by disgruntled bikers with iPhones. Soon, the whole internet was crackling. What Buck had considered harmless saloon jokes were now being denounced as racial and homophobic slurs. The network vice president in charge of Bayou Brethren told the vice president in charge of corporate relations to release a statement expressing dismay at Buck's crude remarks. An overcooked apology was made to gays, African Americans, women, and anyone else who might have been offended. Meanwhile, the show's primetime advertisers were under attack in the blogosphere, and by midday the ACLU had called for a boycott of all fishing flies tied with rooster feathers from the Nance farm. Word of the backlash sent the network vice president in charge of Bayou Brethren lunging for a pre-lunch Xanax. He couldn't fathom why neither Buck nor his manager Lane Coolman would answer their cell phones. The whereabouts of the other Nance brothers, Cleroy, Buddy, and Junior, had been ascertained. They were chilling at the 40-acre Pensacola estate leased by the network and used as an outdoor set for the fractious family barbecue scenes that closed each episode. Down the road a stretch was the rooster farm, which the clan avoided except during taping days because of the stench. The writers had decided that Buck Nance's brothers should refer to him as Captain Cock when quarreling on the show, and inevitably the sleeveless T-shirt bearing that nickname became the top seller of all Bayou Brethren merchandise. Buck had been wearing one on stage at the Parched Pirate, but now the shirt was in a dumpster on Whitehead Street, and the remains of his famous beard were in a bowl of ricey gunk at some restaurant he'd ducked into while fleeing the imaginary lynch mob. The puny kitchen scissors had left him with nappy bristles exposing a weak jawline that he hadn't seen in years. His bare face looked pasty and shrunken, and in no way resembled the imposing Moses-like visage on his TV show. Which was good, in a way. Buck Nance feared that if he were recognized on the streets of Key West, he would be set upon and sodomized by militant homos, Negroes, and other socialist-leaning minorities, a rioting of godless heathens. His survival plan was to blend with the common civilians until he could be safely extricated by Lane. The night was spent in a banyan tree listening to stray cats Scrap and Screw. Buck didn't sleep a wink. At dawn, he climbed down, shivering, and walked to Mallory Square, where he dozed off on a public bench. Soon he was jarred awake by the horn of an arriving cruise ship. The sun felt warm on his shoulders, promising a better day. Having lost his phone in the fray at the Parched Pirate, Buck entered a shop on Duval Street to purchase a disposable. There, he learned that despite the island's laid-back reputation, shirtless men with fresh scrapes and bruises aren't welcome in all establishments. He also discovered that his engraved sterling money clip had apparently fallen from his trousers when he scrambled up the banyan tree, meaning he had no cash or even credit cards, which he always tucked between the $100 bills. Somewhere on Simonton, he shoplifted a random T-shirt that bore a nonsense caption, "Where is Bum Farto?" He darted into a bougainvillea-fringed courtyard to put on the shirt, and out of habit, he tore off the sleeves. An artist sitting languidly before an easel offered Buck $50 to pose nude, and Buck's response was to punch a fist through the blank canvas and stomp off. The artist considered calling the police, but decided on a nap instead. Florida's beaches erode pitilessly, the unstoppable rise of sea level presenting a nightmare scenario for waterfront hotels, coastal developers, and real estate agents. Once upon a time, you could get away with selling submerged land to faraway rubes, but those days were over. Now, buyers wanted to visit the property first, and not by paddleboard. Likewise, high-end vacationers to the Sunshine State derived no tropical enchantment from the sight of waves crashing through their hotel's lobby. Climate change created a boom for a hurricane-spawned industry known as beach renourishment, a process by which thousands of tons of sand are dredged from the sea shallows and dumped on shore to replace the acreage washed away by nature. The enterprise is as costly as it is futile, though for a few glorious months the shoreline appears authentic, if not pristine. This fluffing of public beaches is funded by helpless taxpayers, while privately held oceanfront is often augmented at the expense of the property owners. Either way, beach renourishment deals are fabulously profitable for the contractors because the job never expires. Every grain of sand you dump gets washed away. Martin Trabeau had purchased a fleet of marine barges using the proceeds from a poshly falsified BP oil spill claim. He named the new dredge company Sedimental Journeys, and before long he locked up the replenishment rights for eroding beachfront in 5 Florida counties, 97 miles in all. Flagrantly generous to local politicians at election time, Trabeau was repaid by the hundredfold when the bids fell his way. As a cutter of corners, he soon got in trouble for dredging too near the shore. The bulky equipment and piping were unsightly, and the pumping method churned the surf to a murky hue that offended tourists who came to Florida expecting the Atlantic Ocean to be somewhat blue. Trabeau's heedless bottom-sucking technique also killed catfish, littering the newly buffed beach with bloated, whiskered corpses that deterred all but the hardiest of sunbathers. Over time, companies such as Sedimental Journeys vacuumed so much sand from Florida's coastal seabeds that Trabeau and his competitors were forced to search elsewhere for product. The Bahamas seemed the obvious choice because the sand there was of superb quality and the barge trip across the Gulf Stream was short. Trabeau rented a plane and scouted digging locations along the Bahama banks, less than 80 nautical miles from fast-sinking Palm Beach. A lawyer in Freeport obtained the necessary permits in exchange for a modest commission based on the tonnage shipped. Everybody involved was rolling in dough until the Commonwealth abruptly terminated its arrangement with Sedimental Journeys. An international enviro group had produced a scientific study showing that the sand collection operation had silted the reefs, suffocating the coral and dispersing the tropical marine life that tourists paid so dearly to see. Disheartening underwater footage was provided to all major media outlets, including the BBC. The Bahamian government, which is sensitive to negative publicity in the same way kittens are sensitive to firecrackers, immediately shut down Trabeau's dredging rigs. With orders backing up, he turned to a Miami rock mining proprietor who assured him that a credible approximation of telegenic beach sand was abundant in a burrow pit being excavated on the eastern edge of the Everglades. This claim turned out to be spurious. The texture of the load delivered to Trabeau more closely resembled shrapnel than sugar granules. He spread it anyway. Among his disgruntled clients were the municipality of Boynton Beach and the Royal Pyrenees Hotel and Resort, whose guests, in unmanageable numbers, were complaining of lacerated feet and, among small children making sandcastles, shredded fingers. Martin Trabeau could safely ignore the half-assed threat of litigation from the city's attorney, but he was foolhardy to brush off the outcry from the proprietors of the Royal Pyrenees. The hotel had been built with union pension funds controlled by the Calzone crime family, which continued to manage the property and take an avid interest in the cash flow.
Viral videos of bloodied tourists with their wailing toddlers were bad for business, and the Calzone organization believed that Martin Trabeau was obligated to replace the defective beach behind the Royal Pyrenees immediately. This view hardened after a geologist hired by the hotel reported that the newly deposited sand was actually a slapdash mixture of crushed limestone, recycled asphalt fragments, and broken glass. The whitish gleam of the grit was attributed to industrial bleaching. While the mobsters appreciated a novel fraud when they saw one, they did not enjoy being its victims. A capo named Dominic Big Noogie Ayola left a message on Martin Trabeau's phone instructing him to appear at the Royal Pyrenees on a certain morning at 10 sharp. Trabeau, who was partying on South Beach with a decertified yoga instructor, listened to the voicemail but opted not to call back. Instead, he sent a text saying he had to leave town on a family emergency. Big Noogie was doubtful, and an experienced stakeout man was dispatched to Trabeau's condominium building on Collins Avenue. Once Trabeau's lie was verified, a plan was devised to snatch his ass and reorder his priorities. For a sawbuck, the doorman at the high-rise offered up the information that Trabeau would be departing the next day for Key West in a rented silver Buick due to the fact that his Lexus coupe was in the shop. From a safe phone, Big Noogie placed a call to a person known as Zito, who agreed to arrange a bump-and-grab on the overseas highway. Zito bragged that he used a Czech driver who was the best in the business. Yet, somehow, the job got screwed up, and the Sandman remained at large. Big Noogie was irate. The county had roped off the beach behind the Royal Pyrenees as a public health menace, and droves of limping guests were checking out of the hotel. The bosses in New York demanded an explanation. Meanwhile, Martin Trabeau was lapping a Bloody Mary on the deck at Louis' backyard in Key West, pondering his next move. From across the straits beckoned Havana, or rather a romanticized vision of Havana, for Trabeau had never been there. He'd heard the music scene was sensational, the women heart-stoppingly beautiful. It was said that Cuba's beaches put all others in the Caribbean to shame, and Trabeau didn't doubt that. Perhaps the Castro brothers would sell him some of their sand. Chapter 3. The bride-to-be said her name was Deb. She wore pressed white slacks, designer sandals, and a swipe of liver-colored lipstick that matched her toenails. She said she preferred her coffee with almond milk, which Yancey didn't stock, so she settled for cream. This was after he'd put on some clothes. "You're definitely not a cop," she said, eyeing a half-smoked joint on the kitchen counter. "It's medicinal." "For what? Sunburn?" "Okay, it's evidence," he said. "I was field testing for purity." Deb pointed at the Remington 12-gauge in the corner. "What do you need that for? Is it loaded?" "Of course. You know what they call an unloaded shotgun?"
"What?"
"A stick," he said.
"Are you the lunatic that killed the drone?"
"Was that yours?"
"Our realtors," Deb said. "He was making a video of the property, and somebody shot his little toy out of the sky. $2,000. Boom."
"I've still got the pieces somewhere."
The real estate agent's drone had hovered too closely one afternoon while Rosa was sunbathing topless behind the house. With a single blast, Yancey had demolished the craft and its tiny camera. It was way more fun than shooting clay pigeons. Afterward, the realtor had hysterically called the sheriff's office, which determined Yancey had broken no laws.
"The point is, you don't want me for a neighbor," he said to Deb. "I'm a volatile individual."
She set down the coffee cup.
"Will you help me find my engagement ring or not? My fiancé doesn't know I lost it, and I don't want him to find out." As she spoke, she dragged theatrically on an electronic cigarette tipped with a neon blue light. Yancey was aching to tell her how preposterous she looked. He said, "So, who's the lucky fellow? What's his story?"
"His name is Brock. We've been together almost a year. He's an attorney. Product liability, pharmaceuticals mainly."
"Where?"
"Miami."
"Home, sweet home," Yancey said.
"He was engaged to someone else when we met."
"Which explains why the rock fell off your finger."
"Yeah, she was a chunk muffin," Deb said. "I was supposed to get the ring resized, but I've been too busy with the new house stuff. Brock'll go ballistic if he finds out what happened. He told me the stone cost $200,000, just the stone. I've looked all over the property, and I can't find the damn thing anywhere. So, officer, can you please help me?"
Yancey said, "I offered last night and was coldly snubbed."
"Well, yeah, you scared the hell out of me."
"And what's changed? I answered the door naked and talk of firearms."
"We can reach an arrangement you'll be comfortable with, definitely."
"Like what?"
"Like the greatest blowjob you ever had," she said, the e-cig bobbing at the corner of her smile. "Seriously, you'll be cross-eyed for a month."
Yancey realized he'd fallen short of his objective, which was to exude menace, not sleaze. "Don't take this personally," he said to Deb, "but I've reached a spiritual plateau where random sex needs to mean something."
"Are you some kind of freak?"
"Save your talents for Brett. I'll help you for free. But first, tell me about the mansion you two are planning to build."
"His name's Brock," Deb snipped, exhaling whitish vapor. 6,000 square feet under air, 2.5 floors plus a Thai roof garden.
Foreseeing the